Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. You know you should try to get more sleep. You know that, right? But it's hard. There's so much to do, so many things to binge on TV. So maybe it wouldn't hurt to stay up just a little bit while longer, huh? Joining me now to talk about just how much sleep you need to stay sharp and other selected short subjects in science is Sophie Bushwick, senior editor at Popular Science. Welcome back, Sophie.
Thanks for having me.
Do you know anybody who gets 8 hours of sleep?
I don't, but it turns out we all should be aiming for that. In the study you mentioned, so the researchers had a group of people. They all got 8 hours of sleep and then went in and did a bunch of cognitive tests. And then for 2 weeks after that, they restricted their sleep schedules. So one group for a few days got 0 hours of sleep at night. And the following day after that sleepless night, they took the same cognitive tests again. And they did much, much worse on them. It was almost as if they were taking the tests while drunk.
Wow.
And even the groups that got a little more sleep also had cumulative problems. So after 3 days where they only got 4 hours of sleep a night, a different group of test subjects also reached the same level as the group that wasn't sleeping at all. And for the people who were getting 6 hours a night, it took them 10 nights to reach the same stage. But the thing is that while they were all performing poorly on these tests, they thought they were doing fine.
Huh. So that 1 hour or 2 hours really makes the difference. So between 6 and 8.
It definitely does, especially over time. So if you're getting 6 hours a night for night after night after night, that's going to have a cumulative effect for you.
Explains a lot of things in my life. You have two stories about fresh water in the U.S. lakes and rivers and such, and one looked at human-made chemicals in water. It was astounding.
Yeah, it was really upsetting. They tested for over 700 different human-made chemicals, and they found more than half of the chemicals they tested for were present in the water and were, you know, able to have an effect on cells, which is, you know, really disturbing news when you consider that 85,000 different chemical compounds are actually manufactured in the U.S. And so the number that they tested for was a fraction of what could be out there.
What kinds of things did they test for? Are we talking about here?
Well, the top 10 items that they would find were, 8 of them were pesticides, and then 2 of them were pharmaceutical compounds. One of them was everybody's favorite, caffeine. Mm. And the other was a compound that's used to treat type 2 diabetes.
Hmm. So if, you know, I'm just thinking out loud now. So if you think you're getting organic food and it has no pesticides or whatever, if it's in the water that they're using to process the food, then maybe you're getting the stuff in there anyhow.
That's a really interesting point. And then another thing is that water treatment plants don't filter out every single one of those chemicals. So some of them could be getting through in the drinking water as well.
Mm. And so this is, and how many places did they say? 35 bodies of water?
Right.
So it's all over the place.
Yeah. They were testing a bunch of different bodies of water, and some of them in rural areas, some of them in urban areas, and then some of them farther away from human habitation, and they found.
There must be stuff they didn't test for that's out there.
Absolutely. There's thousands of chemicals that they didn't test for that could be present.
Wow. You also have a related story. It's quite interesting, about road salt.
Mm-hmm. So this was another study where they tested the water in lakes. And in this case, they were looking at lakes to see if they were getting saltier over time. And they found that if 1% of the area around that lake had been paved, it was very likely that it was getting saltier. And the problem is, you know, when it's winter, people put salt on the roads to prevent ice from forming, and that's getting washed into these lakes. And it could be causing problems because at a certain level of saltiness, plants and animals, native plants and animals to those lakes might not be able to survive.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention what the salt's doing to your lawn, but that's a different...
Yeah.
In your garden, that's a different situation. Let's move on to there's new work on ants as farmers.
The story is actually really cool. So it turns out ants have been farming fungus. They bring fungus into the nest and they feed it on things like leaves, and then they eat the fungus when it's grown. And they've been doing this for 65 million years. And researchers knew at some point in that 65 million years, the fungus and the ants began evolving so that in some species, the ants require a chemical that they require an amino acid that only the fungus makes, and the fungus can't live without the ants to feed them. So researchers wanted to find out where and when did this happen, and they traced it back to a point 30 million years ago when ants and the fungus were living in a desert environment. So for the fungus, being above ground in the dry desert air was not very was not a friendly environment for them. So they were thriving underground in the ants' burrows, where it was more moist and where the ants could tend them. And that's where they think the evolutionary change happened that made the ants and the fungus dependent on each other. And then the ants probably went back to their jungle environment, brought the fungus with them, and now they have the symbiotic relationship.
Maybe that's where the term "there's a fungus among us" came from, you know, living with the ants.
Yeah, the ants could definitely say to each other that they have a fungus among us.
Sorry, it's the weekend. Finally, you have a story about a newly discovered shrimp that's definitely not silent, but deadly.
This is an amazing animal. It's a type of pistol shrimp, so it's kind of like a cousin to the mantis shrimp, which is the shrimp that can punch really hard. But this shrimp has one very large pink claw, and it uses this claw to make a noise that can be 210 decibels. That's loud enough to stun or even kill fish. Compare it to a rock concert. Rock concerts will get up to about 120 decibels. So this can make a noise so much louder than that. And because of the noise and because of the pink claw, researchers have named it after Pink Floyd.
Ooh, is that really? Is the name of the shrimp?
There's the genus name, and then the species name is Pink Floydy.
Pink Floyd. Any other shrimp or animals that come like that?
I mean, there's...
Rock stars or...
There's definitely other shrimp that can make really loud noises underwater. I mentioned the mantis shrimp.
Yeah.
So because they punch so fast, it changes the pressure in the fluid around them, and then it creates these sort of pockets that implode. And so the mantis shrimp also makes a really loud noise. I don't know that you'd want to, you know, rock along to it. But
I did. I actually used to have a little aquarium. I used to have a little reef aquarium in my living room. And I used to have a mantis shrimp in it, and you could hear it. It was really, you know, when you don't know it, it's clicking and whatever at nighttime, the lights are out. It turns out it's the shrimp that's, I think, almost breaking the sound barrier. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you. Sophie Bushwick is senior editor at Popular Science. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Modern smartphones come with a whole suite of sensors. They can count your steps. They can know when you're tilting your screen. But those sensors come with a downside. Writing this week in the International Journal of Information Security, researchers explain that under the right conditions, these sensors could be a security threat. Joining me now to talk about it is one of the authors of that paper. Maryam Mernizad is a research fellow in computing science at Newcastle University in Newcastle upon Tyne in the UK. Welcome to Science Friday.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You made a demonstration program that can monitor the accelerometers on an Android phone?
Yeah, well, basically, it's not only on Android phone. It could be on any mobile phone because it's via the web browser. So as long as you open any web browser on any of our devices, the program can work.
So you have your phone open, you have a web browser on it, and you're moving your finger around on the screen, and the program can detect where your finger's going?
Yeah, basically from the sensor measurements coming from motion and orientation, we have developed programs here which can identify if you have been scrolling down, up, right or left, if you've been zooming in and out, or even if you have entered a PIN, for example.
Wow, could it know where on the screen you pressed to know what PIN number you were putting?
Yeah, that basically works based on the way that you hold your phone and those very slight changes when you press a digit.
So did you try to figure out how what the likelihood of someone using this to crack a phone might be?
Well, basically, as I explained, if the code is already loaded in the web page that you open, and we can use machine learning algorithms, and then we can, based on processing and analyzing the sensor data, we can output the PIN that you have pressed on the phone.
Now, how accurate is that?
With the algorithms that we have, it could be over 70% accurate in the first try, and it goes up to 100% in the fifth try.
Wow. So if your phone has a lockout, let's say, after 10 tries, then chances are if you get up to the fifth try, you could get in there before getting locked out.
Yeah. Well, basically, these sensors can provide us, or hackers, with much more than people would think.
Oh, so tell me, what do you mean much more? How much more?
Because these sensors are very accurate, so they can figure out very slight changes that happen on the device. So it could reveal a lot of information about the users, as we proved pins, touch actions, and of course people know about all of these fitness trackers if you're sitting, walking, running, and all of those other physical activities.
So I guess the point is, if you can do it, then the hackers can do it.
Well, I think so.
And people notice when the phone asks for permission to access the camera or the address book. So is the answer here just to make it ask for permission to access the sensors too?
Well, that could be the simplest thing that comes to our mind. But the thing that we have listed over 25 different sensors on the current smartphones, it could be very unusable for the users to get notification for each single user every time that they open a web application or when they install an app. So it's a battle between security and usability, really.
Once again, so what is there to do, Dr. Mirnazad? What should people do to better protect their security?
Well, at the moment, we're working with the industry to figure out what we can do to provide in the platform side. But people always can improve their security and privacy via the general security that advice that we have for them. For example, they can make sure that they change their PINs and passwords regularly. And if you don't need any app or browser window, don't leave it open in the background there and just close it. And you can also uninstall the apps that you no longer need. Mm. Also, keeping update your operating system would help all the time.
Yeah.
And installing applications from approved app stores would help us as well.
Maria Mirnazad is a research fellow in computing science at Newcastle University, Newcastle upon Tyne, UK. Thanks for being with us. Have a good weekend. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back and look at the way politicians speak about science. David Levitan, the book, Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science, all coming up after the break, so stay with us.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How often, when asked about global warming or evolution, have you heard politicians claim,
I'm not a scientist.
I'm not a scientist.
I was not an evolutionary biologist.
I'm not qualified to debate the science over climate change.
The good old I'm not a scientist line. That was Mitt Romney, Mitch McConnell, Bobby Jindal, and John Boehner. On the surface, it sounds like they're simply admitting that they don't know. But my next guest says that line is just one of many tactics that politicians use to confuse and undermine science. Strategies like the cherry pick, the butter up and undercut, and the credit snatch. They sound like episodes on The Big Bang Theory, but David Levitan says they are strategies in politicians' playbooks to discredit well-accepted science. Levitan is a science journalist and author of the new book, Not a Scientist, How Politicians mistake, misrepresent, and utterly mangle science. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, so what's wrong when the politicians say, I'm not a scientist? What does that phrase convey to you?
Well, to me, it just sounds like a bit of a dodge. They're admitting something which is obvious. I mean, most politicians are clearly not scientists, and they're not economists or experts in the Middle East or anything else. But generally speaking, we trust politicians to seek out expert advice. But in this case, because science sort of is a bit of a maybe a bit more obscure than some topics to some people, they use that line just as a way to sort of pretend like there's no way of knowing something, or that the scientists themselves are sort of sitting off in the corner and shouldn't be trusted. And then, of course, they go right on and act on these things that they don't know about anyway.
Is there one phrase that you think of over all the phrases in your book that bothers you the most? What tactic they use?
I would say, I mean, I go back and forth on this sometimes. They all bother me a little bit. The one that I call the ridicule and dismiss might bother me the most. This is a tactic where politicians will describe usually basic scientific research in very silly sounding terms, which you can do with a whole lot of basic research just because it is basic by nature. You're studying things in mice or in fruit flies or any number of very small and insignificant seeming model organisms in other fields. But obviously we use those types of studies to build on each other over many years and decades to arrive at very important findings. It strikes me as so disingenuous to pretend these types of studies are useless when in fact they're incredibly useful. So that might be the one that gets to me the most.
Yeah. I remember once there was some research with a shrimp on a treadmill that no one wanted to talk about, or they all wanted to talk about.
I think that was one of the ones included in the waste book, Tom Coburn's list of government, you know, waste or unnecessary spending, which some other politicians have taken up the mantle since he left Congress. But yeah, they pretend that things like you know, a shrimp on a treadmill just sounds ridiculous. But when you describe it in sort of more thorough fashion, you can often start to see why something like that might be useful.
You have a lot of catchy names for these categories. Let me bring up another one, the butter up and cut down.
Butter up and undercut, yeah. That one is basically the idea that some sort of scientific topics are very hard to criticize outright. So things like cancer research or NASA in particular is very popular. These are things that the public likes. So it's harder for a politician to just outright criticize them. So instead, they sort of use some misdirection. They'll talk about how great NASA is, but in doing so, they are actually setting the stage to try and cut its funding on certain things. I mean, as we've seen in recent years and again this year, there have been sort of threats to cut NASA's earth science funding, which means studying climate change. But you can't just say NASA does bad things because people like NASA. Right. So instead, you talk it up, you butter it up, and then try and sort of cut its legs off.
And you cut the budget out.
Right,
see,
exactly.
It's great, but let's cut the budget anyhow. Our number, 844-724-8255, talking with Dave Levitan, author of Not a Scientist. Boy, have I heard that term so often. How politicians mistake, misrepresent, and utterly mangle science. What is the bottom line on all of that, Dave? Well, why are they doing that? Is this because it's the only way they know how to take on science?
I mean, that's a great question. And to be honest, I try to avoid assigning intent to most of the errors I talk about in the book, just because it's a bit tough to say, you know, this person is lying. They're outright lying about something. But I do think, you know, there you can trace a lot of these things to sort of money in politics and special interest groups. And, climate change plays a big role in the book. And obviously the fossil fuel industry has a very vested interest in continuing to make people a little more confused about science. And as long as that's true, it's going to be hard to avoid some of these things.
Let me bring up one that makes me pull my hair out. And that is, in your book, you call it the straight up fabrication. I want to read a section. You say, this is arguably the most depressing of the errors covered here. Politicians simply relying on the idea that the loudest voice is often considered the most correct, whether or not their point is defensible or fact-based. I mean, fabrication, just making something up, how do you fight that?
That's a great question. I think sometimes some of the examples I cover are so ridiculous that it's actually not that hard to fight. Generally, the public will respond in sort of dramatic fashion when some of these very egregious examples come up. One of them I talk about is the Todd Akin's mention of legitimate rape, which was just sort of a horrifying episode, but which the public really did respond to very quickly, and the media did respond very quickly as well. Some of the other ones, though, can be a little tougher. When a politician just sort of makes something up that they don't cite a source, they don't, you know, actually explain the science behind it, they're just kind of making something up, it can be really hard if you're not an expert in that field to really sort of cut through what they're talking about. I don't have a great answer for sort of what you can do other than sort of stay skeptical, I guess.
Yeah.
If something sounds ridiculous, it probably is, and you can look it up and try and figure it out.
You know, and even now they're resorting to discrediting the respected journals, you know, that like Science Magazine. How do you answer that?
Right, that's another tough one. Yeah, in the House Science Committee's hearing a little while ago, Lamar Smith said that Science Magazine was not an objective journal, which is really just kind of shocking to hear from a politician. I'm not sure how to combat it other than just to keep telling him he's wrong. That has a journal like that has such a long history of objective scientific pursuits that it's hard to just say anything other than, well, no, it is objective.
Is there any training? I mean, do politicians get formal training in how to obfuscate and say these things?
No, I don't think they do. I think there's a lot of repetition involved. I think, you know, just with the title of the book, you can see with Not a Scientist. I mean, it's not like someone told them all to say this. It just they all sort of started saying it and realized it seemed to work for a little while. So they all sort of repeated it. And I think a lot of times politicians will go with what works. Right. As long as you seem to be getting your message out to the people you feel you need to get your message out to, why stop, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Do you find this is works on both sides of the aisle? Do politicians from all the parties say the same thing?
There are definitely some examples that cross party lines, and there are certainly people on both sides of the aisle that have, you know, made errors in scientific topics. I try to in the book to stay away from you know, partisan statements, but it's very hard to deny that one party has largely abandoned scientific rigor and evidence in the last couple of decades. So I don't pretend that, you know, I go half and half on the examples there, but the techniques, the rhetoric, the devices they use could be used by anybody and have been used by anybody. If you go back far enough, some of these topics have crossed the aisle sort of in who was getting it wrong or getting it right. And there's nothing to say that it couldn't change in the future.
Let's go to the phones to Newark, New Jersey. Hi, Dan. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I am a scientist, a lover of science, want every kid to have math. I really am totally on your side about environment, but I just think there's a certain arrogance that borders on insolence with which you guys respond, and you don't realize that these guys are setting you up. So by the way you respond, you antagonize the people who otherwise are just listening. And I think that especially you, because I listen to you every Friday, have to come up and understand the humility and the real concern that people have. Because, you know, if you...
Do you have an instance? Can you give me an example of what you're talking about?
Yes. Instances where there is a division between a massive economic displacement and a partial environmental issue involving animals or whatever, you know. I don't want to give you any particular case, but...
I'm asking for some evidence. I need some evidence.
Well, we deal in
evidence-based stuff, you know.
I'm asking you for introspection, because we are now in a position where if we lose, there's nobody else to save the future for our kids.
I understand. I understand what you're saying,
so
but...
I'd like to respond to an instance. Point that I get the chance to present the problem, and you can introspect about it and ask yourself, because I didn't go through all your programs before getting on the phone today. But okay. If that's what I have to do, I will and write in. But it would be nice if you guys start asking yourselves.
We had to drop that call. Let's move on. What do you say to Dave? What do you say to somebody like that?
Well, it's an interesting question, I suppose. He had a colorful way of addressing it, I suppose. But I think there's certainly some value to all of us thinking about the way we communicate, and especially on scientific topics, which, you know, can be very complicated. And if you know, for anyone who isn't particularly aware of them, can be confusing. So that's fair to mm-hmm. certainly ask the question, are we communicating well enough? Or are we just assuming people should know things? In terms of responding to political attacks on science, I think the idea that we should sort of, there's a little bit of both sidesism there, right? That you should let the attack stand because you don't want to be mean to the people who agree. It doesn't make a ton of sense to me when something like you know, destroying the climate is at yeah. stake.
Well, he raised one kernel of a point, and that is, what is the media's role in all of this? Are they complicit in the problem if there's no pushback or the sound bites are so small and they're allowed to stand? I mean, shouldn't the media? I mean, one of the arguments I've had for over the years with my colleagues who are political reporters is that they never follow up a politician's phraseology with "show me the evidence." They can say anything they want, basically, and no one now they have started doing a little bit, but no one says, "What's the evidence present?" You know, I mean, science journalists were always asking for evidence.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point, and it's incredibly important to require evidence for any claim from any, you know, political party, from any politician, elected official, et cetera. The media has to be the one, I think, as the sort of first line of defense to say, well, okay, you said that, but, you know, if there's no evidence for it, then what are we supposed to do with that? But I guess I do think that the media has gotten a little bit better about that in recent years. I think there is sort of a general trend toward requiring evidence when evidence should be so easy to provide in the age of, you know, any study is available in 10 seconds on Google.
Mm-hmm. I know that a science advisor has not yet been named in the Office of Science and Technology Policy as those director. Will this contribute to these issues?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. It really seems like quite a contrast from that office, OSTP, under President Obama when Dr. John Holdren was the science advisor and the director, to now when it's there's just no one there, really. I think in terms of it contributing to the issue, it really depends how this administration uses that office. I think there are differences across administrations. Sometimes a science advisor can play a really vocal role and can really sort of guide the administration's policies and guide how science is treated at the highest levels of government. Other times, not so much. Mm-hmm. So it really depends who is installed there. Obviously, we don't know who, if anyone, will end up there. Some of the names that have been floated have been a little bit scary to certain people in the scientific community, I would say. But I don't think we'll know until they actually start filling out those positions.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Sorry if a little epithet may have slipped through earlier. We tried to hit the button as fast as we could, but sometimes they get out. The science of a lot of things can be very complicated, and oversimplification is one of the things you talk about, and by having to make it into little sound bites so that it actually gets picked up. Is there a better way that politicians could talk about these topics?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a tough question, because obviously there is some benefit to boiling things down into usable quotes and usable teachable moments. I mean, it's not, you know, I'm not indicting the entire idea of explaining things quickly and simply, but if you take a very complicated topic and just spout a soundbite that does not have evidence behind it, then you're really sort of doing everyone a disservice. I mean, you can't require that every politician, every time, you know, they give a speech or every time they send out a tweet, that they have, you know, paragraph after paragraph of nuanced discussion. But I think it would help to sort of, you know, if a politician has decided he's going to make a certain thing an issue, then offer up some evidence on a website, a campaign website, or a, congressional website or whatever the case may be, just providing the most context possible in whatever form that takes would be useful rather than just, you know, one sentence and then done.
Mm-hmm. And any last thoughts on where we go from here with all of this?
Well, you know, I think it can feel like a sort of depressing moment in terms of science to some people I know. And I guess I would encourage people to look at the bright side. There's a science march happening next weekend, and there's movement to bring scientists into government, which I think is a great idea. I think there is an impressive mobilization toward just an appreciation for scientific rigor and evidence and empiricism and things that really would improve the political discourse if they sort of entered into that realm a little more. So it sounds like a bad time, but maybe it's not quite as bad as we think.
Thank you, David. David Levitan, author of Not a Scientist, How Politicians Mistake, Misrepresent, and Utterly Mangle Science. Thanks for being with us today. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're headed to Mars, or a simulation of it, in Hawaii. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Venture to the southern coast of the Big Island in Hawaii, and what you'll see is some of the most primordial landscape on Earth. Fresh lava oozing into the ocean, casting up a plume of volcanic steam. Huge expanses of black lava crust and active steam vents with sauna-like temperatures. Scientists believe the surface of Mars may have been similar 3 to 4 billion years ago, when the planet was warmer and wetter than it is today, which makes Hawaii an ideal place to study geology similar to ancient Mars, and a place to model a mission to the red planet, too. NASA simulated the three parts of a human-led scientific mission, the fieldwork, the habitat, and ground support back to Earth, in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Science Friday producer Christopher Taliata joined them there.
It's hard enough to troubleshoot wireless networks and configure IP addresses from the comfort of your couch. But NASA's Mike Miller, he's doing it in whipping wind, mist, and fog on the edge of a crumbly volcanic crater.
Hey, yeah.
Miller just lost everything.
You're kidding. All right.
Getting the laptop out, that doesn't sound good.
It's a tough book, but it's a mile tough book, so I don't know. Try to figure out how tough it is, and I don't want to find out the hard way because it's the only one we have in the field.
Mike's based at the Kennedy Space Center, but his job site today, the Mana'ulu Crater in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island. The ground's so hot in places, it's steaming. In fact, Mike is sitting next to one of those volcanic vents right now.
Feels really good right now.
The rig he's setting up looks like a mini cell phone antenna. Mike says it's a lot like the rugged communications hubs we might set up for the first Martian astronauts. And the lava landscape around us recalls the volcanic views on Mars. But the ancient Mars, billions of years ago, when the planet was warmer and wetter than it is today. The charred crust around the crater has huge folds and ropes of shiny black dried-up lava. It's brittle and crunches under our boots.
Like really crispy chocolate chip cookies.
When we hiked out here this morning, it was Hawaiian license plate weather. Clear skies and a big rainbow over the lava fields. Now, everything's foggy and wet. But Mike's optimistic.
I have a feeling Mars is a little bit more miserable than mist and fog.
And Mars is why we're here. Because this communications rig is one small part of a bigger mission to model a human-led scientific trip to Mars, right here on Earth on the side of an active volcano. The project's called BASALT. That's a geology joke, and it stands for Biologic Analog Science Associated with Lava Terrains. And it's a three-part simulation. The first part, astronauts roaming the lava doing field work. Second, another set of astronauts in the HAB, the Mars colony. And then there's ground support back on Earth. That's where I caught up with NASA's Darlene Lim. She's the principal investigator.
A lot of times, I start into the whole process of the fact that we're doing real science under simulated Mars mission conditions, and then right away I get asked, well, do you have spacesuits?
They don't. But this mission models nearly every other challenge a scientific mission to Mars might face, including a big one, the massive time delay in communications between Earth and Mars.
You're looking at anywhere between a 4 to about a 24-minute one-way delay between when you say hi and the other person receives that hello, and you need to figure out what to say in return.
The delay varies depending where Earth and Mars are in their orbits, but worst case scenario, about 45 minutes to say hi and get a hello back. So for NASA Mission Control, accustomed to just a couple seconds round-trip delay between the Earth and Moon, this is a game changer.
What we're proposing is a paradigm shift from what is currently done in the human spaceflight community. It's like you're living in the present, but you have to affect the future, and that future is actually already the past.
And that mind-bending scenario is why NASA gathered a team of 50 people here last November to simulate that logistical headache in a real mission setting, with the same sorts of all-stars you might actually want to send to Mars. Geologists, biologists, chemists, computer coders, and electrical engineers, educators, roboticists, and experts on human physiology and performance. There's a former astronaut, too. For the next 10 days, they'll test comms equipment and time delays and reimagine what happens when mission control loses some of that real-time control part. And there's one more twist. This mission is also doing real science, astrobiology studies on how rock and water interact, and which lava rocks are the best hideouts for life. It's work that could someday determine which rocks astronauts turn over on Mars. The stakes are high. Today's scientific mission begins with two astronauts out on the lava beds, the first part of the simulation. We hike down to join them once Mike's comms equipment boots up.
We want some hot chocolate when we get back into the habitat.
That astronaut is Kara Beaton. She's an engineer from Johnson Space Center.
Hey, Mike, it's Kara. I got you loud and clear.
KSGCOM, EV2, loud and clear.
Her fellow astronaut is Rick Elphick, a NASA geologist. They've got knee pads, iPhones strapped to their left arms, laminated flipbooks of instructions on their right arms. They've got video cameras on their chests, too, and 40-pound packs. Antennas shaped like corn dogs and mushrooms stick out the top. They are fully loaded.
Okay, good morning from the field. I believe we are standing on waypoint zero right now. I do have tracking on both of us on my wrist display.
Kara and Rick are walking a pre-planned traverse across the lava, and they'll stop at sample sites Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie along the way. At each site, they'll take pictures and describe rock samples, and they'll identify the minerals and elements in the rocks using ray gun-looking things that shoot infrared light and X-rays. Kara's getting a reading now.
Gmelinite-sodium, 3 stars. Montmorillonite.
Kara's descriptions travel back in real time to the other Martian astronauts in the Mars HAB.
Hematite, 3 stars. SWIR, no.
The HAB is actually a back office at the Kilauea military camp, and it is the second part of this simulation. Shannon Kobes-Novotniak is one of those Martians.
Welcome to Mars. You are now a Martian. Are you ready for some good potatoes? I hear we have them.
She's a geologist at Idaho State University.
And I'm the scientist in the equivalent of the Mars habitat, helping give science guidance to the astronauts as they're walking out on the surface.
Under the mission scenario, Shannon made the years-long journey to Mars, too, along with Kara and Rick. But she gets to hang out in the HAB today, which helps her focus on the science.
I've got plenty of air. I'm not as stressed physically. And I can write things down so I have a larger context view. It's my job to be their memory and to feed that back to them when they need it. And at the same time, condense the information down to the most critical parts from a scientific perspective and send it back to the Earth.
Today's experiment is running with a 15-minute one-way communications delay back to Earth. So everything you just heard the astronauts saying out in the field, the mineral IDs, the hot chocolate order, Shannon heard it because she's on Mars time. But no one on the Earth part of this simulation even knows that happened yet. In fact, with this delay, if you sent a message from Mars at the beginning of this story, right now, it would only be halfway to Earth. Shannon in the Mars habitat is that link between the astronauts out sampling and the hive mind of a dozen geologists and biologists back at Mission Control. That's the third part of the simulation, happening in a big conference room at the military base. The scientists are on Earth time, and they're desperately waiting to hear which rocks the astronauts sample. So as soon as the first time-delayed transmission comes in, the debate begins.
Okay, Alpha Delta does not look good from this point. I can see high-temperature oxidation.
And that's just kind of covering.
Which of these do you actually want to scan?
They have a leaderboard projected on the wall where each new rock is ranked by how interesting it seems.
Okay, is everybody in pretty much in the science area back here satisfied with that list as it is? Okay.
That scientific consensus will be beamed back to Mars. And this scientific debate, Shannon says, is how real Martian astronauts may someday be guided to pick up the most scientifically relevant samples.
Any rock we take from Mars will be of huge benefit, right? But we only get limited choices. We need them to be the best possible ones.
Of course, exploration by its nature means not everyone gets to go. What this research project is trying to figure out is, how do you bottle up all that human experience, all that scientific expertise here on Earth, and send it tens or even hundreds of millions of miles away? How do you offload some of that mission control to the astronauts themselves, who will not only be distant, but living beyond instant communication? Principal Investigator Darlene Lim again.
You only get to send six people who are supposed to represent humanity and make discoveries for, say, maybe thousands of scientists back home. And so we're trying to make sure that the humanity is not stripped from human exploration. You have that element represented in the room in such a deep sense. You got to be able to draw that out in the science team. And then you got to be able to allow those that are on Mars to bear down on their experience in that way as well, and bring it together to force out the most amazing discoveries. And it's going to be science, but it's going to be an art to it as well.
It'll be a while before we figure it all out. And it may be a while, too, before humans venture far enough in space to truly outgrow the idea of Earth-based mission control. But when we do, Darlene will be ready.
I would just like to see somebody go to Mars and to turn over a rock. That would be a good day.
For Science Friday, I'm Christopher Intagliata.
A simulated Mars mission in Hawaii, and we have lots of beautiful photos, video, field sounds, and a great write-up by our web producer, Lauren Young. And you can check it all out at sciencefriday.com/Hawaii. That's sciencefriday.com/Hawaii. Speaking of life on other worlds, new research on data from NASA's Cassini mission is raising the stakes for Saturn's moon Enceladus. Not only is it expelling plumes of water vapor from cracks in its icy shell, but these plumes seem to be coming from hydrothermal vents under an ocean, and the plumes are full of hydrogen. If I were a microbe living on a hydrothermal vent on Earth, then hydrogen would be a tasty source of energy. Does this mean we might find microbes on Enceladus? Here with a few more insights is Scott Bolton, a co-investigator on Cassini and co-author on the new research in the journal Science. He's based at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Tell us, this was special kind of hydrogen that Cassini found in these plumes?
No, it's not actually special hydrogen. It's just the fact that there is this excess hydrogen there that is so interesting. Mm-hmm. The question is, how's it being produced? Where is it coming from? And is that a hint that maybe this is the food for microbes?
And where do you think it might be coming from?
Well, you know, Enceladus is too small to really have a whole bunch of hydrogen that it's just holding on to, because it doesn't have the gravity field to hold on to something that is a very, very light element. Hydrogen's the most common element in the whole universe, but we don't expect a lot of it sitting on Enceladus. Of course, Enceladus has an ocean, and on Earth, we see hydrogen being produced in hydrothermal activity. In other words, under the deep sea, the water meets the rock, and some chemistry occurs, and hydrogen is released. And on the Earth, actually, life starts off of this energy or this food source. And so when we see that Enceladus has this hydrogen coming out, it was sort of unexpected. Of course, we were searching for it because of the link to the way Earth works. And we know that it has these deep oceans, and it's putting out these geysers. And so the idea that we've proposed, and we've researched a lot of different ideas trying to come up with an alternative theory, is that actually there's hydrothermal activity going on deep in the ocean on Enceladus, and it may be producing white and black smokers, kind of like what we see on Earth.
And if there are white and black smokers on Earth, there might be what on Enceladus?
There might be life. All around these deep vents, we have these big hydrothermal, very deep hydrothermal vents on the Earth. And we call them white and black smokers because they put out white smoke or what looks like white smoke or black smoke, depending on how much sulfur is tied into it. But basically what you have is you have minerals that are very rich in iron interacting with water. And when they interact with the water, they form new minerals, and in the process, they release hydrogen. And around these vents, these hydrothermal vents on the Earth, we see tons of life forms. This was only discovered a few decades ago, but nobody expected all this kind of life there. And what it changed our perspective on the Earth as far as where life is and how common it is, because here was life forming and thriving under the sea where there's no direct access to sunlight. Before that, I think we had always assumed, scientists had always assumed that sunlight was needed. But here on the Earth, we found lots of life. It may be one of the ways that life started on the Earth is deep in the ocean, and you don't need any sunlight at all. You just have the microbes basically feeding off of this hydrogen, and that's its energy source. And around that region on the Earth, in these hydrothermal vents, you find, you know, little spider crabs, little shrimp, all kinds of different kinds of mussels.
And so you're not looking for that kind of stuff, you know, if you go search Enceladus or even Europa. You're looking for more primitive sorts of things.
We're looking for simple things to measure. To be able to go find a shrimp, we'd have to send a submarine down or something. But when we have water coming out of this ocean, spraying out into space, and if you can fly a spacecraft through that water mist, you can go in and measure whether there's microbes and amino acids and other kinds of things that might be present in that water.
Right.
And so that's really what you're going to go look for, is the next step toward habitability, and is there even primitive life going on in there. If there is, I mean, you could have a much higher life form like a shrimp living there, but we'd have to the first step is to go find out if you think you see microbes.
Well, are we going to send any probes? Are there plans to send probes either to Enceladus or the other, like Europa, which has an ocean too?
Yeah, so Europa has an ocean. These two bodies are considered to be ocean worlds, and it's something that we've recently realized that as NASA scientists, that actually, you know, it's more than just the Earth. It's these moons of the giant planets, the outer planets in particular. So there's a plan to send a mission to Europa. It's being designed and built today. It's called the Europa Clipper, and it would hopefully fly through these plumes. We've seen some plumes on coming out of the ice of Europa through Hubble telescope images, and so we would look for something similar as to what we just saw on Enceladus and even more. And on Enceladus, there are some missions being planned now. They're not approved yet, and they're being studied to be proposed in the next year or so. And so one of them would maybe go to Enceladus with a follow-on mission to Cassini.
Scott Bolton, co-investigator on NASA's Cassini mission out of the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio. We'll be paying close attention. Thanks for joining us today. A note to all you science trivia geeks in the New York City area. We're hosting our third annual trivia night at the Bell House in Brooklyn. On Wednesday, May 10th, there'll be drinks, prizes, and I hope to see all of you. So reserve a spot for your team early. We're going to have teams there. Get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/trivia. That's May 10th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Go to the website, sciencefriday.com/trivia. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman, Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. Have a happy Easter.